criteria that we're talking about with regard to an individual who doesn't have a teaching license, is not pursuing a teaching license, but has the content and subject matter expertise that the school district needs in order to apply. And there's just a demonstration of how that content expertise and the need arose, and it is a pretty easy application to complete. I would say it's within the 30-minute time frame to complete that application. So that adjunct pathway is available outside of the educational pathway.
So then, and then in regard to returning to this specific waiver, if they submit a request, how many pages does it typically run?
It's actually an online application for the emergency authorization. And again, it's about a 30-minute time frame. The individual districts in this case are asked to submit just a short write-up as to why the individual may need. For two of these applicants, this is the paper for all four that was pulled out of the application themselves. So as you can see, these are all five applications. And these were just literally the bullet points that we asked the districts to submit to say, did you try an already licensed pool? Yep, I sure did. It wasn't there. Did you try to find somebody who already had this license or was on that pathway? Yep, I sure did.
So all that's been submitted to CDE for Ms. Aguilar here is on that piece of paper in front of you.
No, I would not say all. So these were the things that we asked the districts to submit. The applicant still goes through an online application where we collect, of course, the pertinent information, their name, their social security number, their information, so that we can ensure that we have a background check on them pursuant to statute. And then the district is asked to just provide supplemental bullet points that they can upload into that application so that we can make a determination. All told, when we work through that process, it's about a 30-minute process to actually apply.
How long does it take you to reach a decision generally?
After the review of the application in general, it is anywhere between 5 and 10 minutes.
Okay.
And some back and forth depending on the questions we may have.
You know, it might be helpful for, I mean, we keep hearing about all the different ways that districts can
found out about a new one today.
Get a warm body in the classroom, and maybe it would be helpful if we knew those.
I got mine this way. So I think all I would ask is that anything can be done. Maybe this process is as streamlined as it can be, but I think it's going to get to be a more common request. I think we need to make sure it's as streamlined as possible, as cost effective as possible. So I move the adoption of 1503 to grant. It's now 14?
Yes.
1403 to grant the initial request or the request for initial emergency authorizations for the five named people.
Do I have a second?
Thank you.
And Board Member McClellan, also, did you have a question?
No, I wanted to know if you wanted a motion, but it's covered.
We're in good shape. Okay. Any objections? Okay. Do we want to go now to 14.04, or do you want to go to, the 17 one is SACPI, right?
Yeah, that's
there, Madam Chair, if we could go into the yellow item, and then after the notice of rulemakings, do the break that you had suggested, and then that'll give staff time to get down for the SACPI and the accountability clock.
So we're at 14.04.
Oh, they're just moving in order. It wasn't removed.
Everybody can find that. This is consideration of the Colorado English Language Learner Education and Professional Development. Commissioner, do you have a staff person? Yes, we do. This poor staff person. Oh.
No, but I'm back. Yes, thank you. I will turn this over to Dr. O'Neill, and I think we can move quickly through the first couple slides because we've talked about that.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the board. Again, I'm Dr. Colleen O'Neill. I'm here to present to you the Colorado English Language Learner Educator Development Pathway option. So today we are going to review why we are having this conversation, which is really about a U.S. Department of Justice inquiry regarding the actual development of our teachers who support our English language learners. We will take the time to review some stakeholder many months ago, back in September, actually a year ago last September, we were asked to go forward with some stakeholder conversation and recommendations, so we're going to bring those back forward to you again today, and then we are going to actually request Board of Education action today. So I will move quickly probably through our presentation, and we'll take any questions as we go through. So a brief context for our students of English language learners. The Equal Educational Opportunities Act, of course, says that no state shall deny equal educational opportunities to an individual on account of his or her race, color, sex, or national origin by an educational agency to take appropriate action to overcome language barriers. That is what we are talking about today. We are talking about whether the Colorado Department of Education has an opportunity to go forward and ensure that we are meeting all English language learner needs. The actual inquiry that came to the Colorado Department of Education from our Department of Justice is, do English language learners, our students, have an opportunity to receive equitable education based on teacher qualifications? So that's the context under which we're having the conversation today. An overview of the current context around that specific inquiry with regard to our teacher qualifications. There is an increase in English learner population in Colorado, which is making it the sixth largest in the nation. We are at approximately 14%. There is a leveling off of individuals who receive an added endorsement or our culturally and linguistically diverse education that serves our English language learners. The U.S. Department of Justice and U.S. Office for Civil Rights are in agreements with 15 districts already in the state of Colorado regarding the appropriate and adequate services for English language learners. So that's 15 districts that are already ensuring that our educators are prepared to teach our English language learner students. The Department of Justice inquiry to the Colorado Department of Education really asked us some questions. How is the Colorado Department of Education actually ensuring that our educators meet the needs of our English language learners from a licensing perspective? And I think that's an important criteria. A little bit more of a snapshot. Over the last 10 years, the number of our English language learners in Colorado's public schools has grown by more than double the rate of growth in total student population. There now are approximately 126,000 English language learners in our state, and it comprises approximately 14% of our total K-12 population. Just under 5% or more of our 100,000 teachers actually hold a Colorado license or an endorsement in a culturally, linguistically, or English language learner pathway. So there is only about 5%. To remind us of a timeline of events, what you'll see up on your screen now
is... Madam Chair, let's interrupt for a question. How many teachers are actually employed full-time in Colorado?
I'm sorry, Mr. Germ, I do not have that off the top of my head. I usually carry the numbers of how many teachers
I thought it was
in
the neighborhood of 45,000. Does that sound right?
A little more than that.
I was going to say 52 is where I... Okay. Is the number sticking in my head? I'm hesitant to say
so
that
when
out loud.
When you use the 100,000 number... That means those teachers have a license but probably aren't active or could be substitutes.
Could be any number
so
of those, yes.
Could you run a statistic on how many are actually employed in the field and what percentage of those have some sort of ELL endorsement versus the overall pool of 100,000? Because if somebody's not active, then you could be kind of overstating the problem a little bit.
I think some of the administrators keep their teachers' licenses also, don't
could,
they?
Could be.
Yeah, that's me
too. But they're not, they're not in the classroom.
They're not in the classroom.
So, yeah.
You're right.
So I just think that's a more apples-to-apples comparison than start using the 100,000.
Thank you very much. I will give a little clarity around the reason we've used the 100,000 is because it's the pool of available educators, which is a contextual piece that we've had conversation with the Department of Justice as well. How many could we have? We could have this many. So I think that's a great
not a good number to give to the Department of Justice. We shouldn't be using that number because I think it's misleading in a way that's hurtful to us. And You know, just because they're in the pool doesn't mean they can swim.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay. The timeline, I'll go back to our timeline conversation just a little bit, just to remind us. This inquiry actually came in 2009 with a contact from the Department of Justice. Since that time, we have been working with them with regard to data questions and or responses to any questions that they have. It was pretty clear that around the 2015 timeframe, they came back in contact with us and asked us what that movement was and what we were doing really about looking at our educators specifically around licensing and endorsement for our English language learners and or those pathways. That's when we brought it back to the board. Since that timeframe, we have amassed our stakeholder conversations. So since then, we have held stakeholder conversations through the course of 15 and 16, beginning in the spring and summer of 16, and then in the late summer of 16. We then came to the Board of Education for a very draft work product at that point in time to have conversation. We took feedback back from that Board of Education meeting. We incorporated it into our conversations, because what we heard very clearly was we wanted more pathways, we wanted extreme flexibility for our educators to ensure that they can meet these requirements but have as many pathways and flexibility as they can. With that, we are coming back now in February of 2017 with a presentation for you as to what that recommendation yielded. So on to the recommendation. Based off of the feedback that we have had from you all as the board, right now the recommendation is to create an integration of English language learner standards into educator preparation programs, be more specific about what those requirements are as we prepare our new teachers to come into the classroom, and then to develop 6 semester hours of professional development that would be required for our current educators as well as our new teachers. A little bit more insight into that ELL, or English Language Learner Educator Development Pathway. What we would be looking at, or the recommendation coming forward at this point, is a revised educator preparation rules that really focus on the English language learner development for our new teachers, developing a flexible approach for all educators to receive English language learner professional development and the pathways around that, and then require 6 semester hours of professional development for current educators. That 6 professional development hours is in complete alignment with the renewal statute, or the statutes around the renewal of educator licenses for every 5 years. With that professional development pathway, we would be ensuring flexible pathways to get professional development for all of our educators. That could mean a district level support, it could mean online learning, it could mean Institutes of Higher Education coming together, our BOCES providing that support, very flexible. At that time, we would also be determining whether there were any other mechanisms by which we could ensure that educators were getting that professional learning, including their past experiences, or whether they need to engage in some district level professional learning. So today we are coming before you with a request that the Board of Education take action on this. There's a recommended action to instruct the Colorado Department of Education staff to work with stakeholders to go forward with some rule development along this continuum. With that, I'm going to stop and entertain any questions or thoughts you might have.
Board Member McCall.
I anticipate there probably will be more questions or discussions, but I'd like to put a motion out on the floor. I move to instruct CDE staff to develop rules for a professional development pathway for current educators and update the educator effectiveness rules with a focus on integration of English language learner strategies.
I second that. Thank you. Questions from colleagues? Should we call the vote?
Sure. Board Member Durham?
No.
Board Member Flores?
Yes.
Board Member Goff?
Yes.
Board Member Masnack?
No.
Board Member McClellan?
Yes.
Board Member Rankin?
Yes.
And Board Member Schroeder?
Yes. So I hope you heard the word flexible. I heard it from you, but it came back from us as well.
Absolutely.
Actually, I would even add incentives. If there are some ways to incentivize an interest in this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Do you want to do rulemaking or take a break?
Let's take a break first.
Yeah. Let's take a break. Okay. 10-minute break?
Yeah, I think that should be, we're caught up on
folks, and then we'll come back to the notice of rulemaking for rules that we don't want.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You're cutting red tape when you come back.
What?
You're cutting red tape.
I'm cutting red tape. Yeah, so that rule that we have, that for every rule we pass, we get rid of two other ones.
Hi,
Steve.
We're on the right path.
Could we please come back to order?
If you knew my uncles.
The next item is a notice of rulemaking for the administration of the Read to Achieve grant program, which no longer exists. Before we begin, I'm wondering if I might have a motion for this one. Anyone ready to make a motion for me?
Is this 1501?
1501.
I move that notice of rulemaking pursuant to 1 CCR 30147 rules for the administration of the Read to Achieve grant program.
Thank you. That's a proper motion. Is there a second?
One second.
Thank you. Should we do all three motions at once? No?
I don't think that's proper.
That's not proper?
No.
All right. Commissioner, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. Yes, I'll turn this over to Leanne M. just to give you a quick overview of this.
Thank you, Leanne M. And this is a continuation of what we heard from Melissa Bloom last month, that we've gone through some rule reviews that are required by statute and have identified three more rules to come forward to be noticed for repeal. These three, and I'm going to just speak to all three at once.
Thank you.
These three, they either no longer exist in statute or they have been never funded. And therefore, if it were ever to be funded, then we could rely on the statutes and potentially come back to you and adopt more rules. So that's what these three are. And then we would come back to you in 2 months seeking to totally repeal.
Great. Any objection to that motion? So that motion passes. I need another motion for 301-48.
Chair, I move to approve the notice of rulemaking for 1 CCR 301-48, rules for the administration of the teacher development program.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's a proper motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Any objections to this motion? Bingo. One more, please.
Madam Chair, I move to approve the notice of rulemaking for 1 CCR 301-49 for the administration of the Science and Technology Education Center grant program.
That's a proper motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you. Are there any objections to this motion? Thank you, folks. So we'll be back in 2 months to get rid of these permanently.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ms. M.
Thank you.
All right. The next item is 1801, accountability clock.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Oops.
Before we do that.
1701. Mm-hmm. All right. Board Member Durham, talk to us about this one, please.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. As I reviewed these contact and background information forms, it struck me that for some reason we're collecting gender and ethnicity information, which if you'll notice on the background information. We do that on all the applicants. Is that required by law?
So I have Darcy Hutchins here, who's our Director of Family Engagement Partnership. Sorry. Yeah. Too many words in my head.
Yeah, right.
So the question was whether or not it's, required in law. So not specifically that we collect gender and ethnicity, but the law does state that we that SACPI should, to the best of its ability, make sure that the parents who are on the committee represent geographically, socioeconomically, ethnically, the populations of Colorado.
And so that is in the statute?
Correct.
So then you think it's almost required to essentially profile these applicants?
So it was SACPI, the State Advisory Council for Parent Involvement in Education, who came up with the application, and they're just trying to collect the data that is most useful to make sure that we have a diverse population as much as possible.
So do we report that to anyone?
No, it's just for internal use.
So non-reporting has consequences, I guess. Well, I just don't think it's appropriate that that those become qualifications for participation, and I think they are obviously a limiting factor. So I don't think we ought to be collecting that kind of information. Just my opinion. So,
well, if the legislation requires...
It doesn't require.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said the legislation does require
So it requires that, to the best of SACPI's ability, that they have select parents to be on the committee that represent the population in Colorado. So that is information that they chose to include just to try to be as diverse as possible.
Okay. So my question...
Board Member Flores.
Thank you. So my question was, why didn't we try and get Black, Hispanic, or other cultures kind of represented of these three? I would have thought that maybe we could have tried to do that. Or did they not apply?
Right. So for the parents, the two parent vacancies that we have, there were only white women who ended up applying. We shared it out through the SCOOP, through district contacts, through various contacts, you know, that different offices in CDE have. So we had to use what we had.
Well, there's one person that I was that I noticed who doesn't seem to know how to write.
Well,
sorry. So I'm thinking that these people have to write reports and stuff. So that was another issue. And then I noticed that one of the other people is a lobbyist who we see here a lot. And so I just kind of wondered. And the other question, the other concern.
There's a lobbyist that's on set?
Well, we see here a lot. Not here today, but most of the time they're here. So I assume that. And the other question I had was that it seems as if we have the charter school league overrepresented. And so there's another charter league of school employee that's here. And they seem to be kind of all over the place. And I was wondering if someone... We could just maybe start asking for public school teachers. And I know that we have a couple here.
Yep. So thank you. I appreciate the question. So in the SACPI legislation, it says that we need a representative who to serve on SACPI who represents a statewide organization for charter schools. And so we actually only have one person. So Lisa, who is on your one of the names that we're seeking approval for today. So she's the only person on SACPI set to actually represent charter schools.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
So you happen to know the percentage of men that are by these since we're supposed to have a diverse group,
right.
You happen to know the answer to that?
Two out of the five parent reps are men.
That's pretty close.
Not bad.
That's good. Okay.
Is anybody ready to make a motion?
I was just going to say that's a lot better than the mix at most PTCO meetings where you hardly see
PTCO. Teacher community organization. There's more to it than that, but I don't.
I was going to make a really quick motion. If I can find it.
Well, you're not going to find it because it was back in. It was
got
back
it.
In the
I hear you. All right, I move to approve item 1701, appointments to the State Advisory Council for Parent Involvement in Education.
Do I have a second? Thank you, Ms. Goff. Do you want to call the roll, please?
Board Member Durham.
Aye.
Okay.
Board Member Flores.
Aye.
Board Member Goff.
Aye.
Board Member Masnack.
Aye.
Board Member McClellan.
Aye.
Board Member Rankin.
Aye.
Board Member Schroeder.
Aye. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Quick question.
Board Member Goff.
Thank you. I wonder
if they're leaving.
Well, it's really a general question.
I wonder before you leave, hang on.
Just I wonder if from now on, whenever we do approve new committee members or such, that the existing committee could be inserted at the end with role function so that we could see who's where we are with that,
sure.
Satisfying the statute and whatever we wish to see in the diversity ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Sure.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next item is an update on the accountability clock hearings. Commissioner, I'll turn this over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the last meeting we have with you all before you actually dive into your decision making around the accountability clock and around the districts and schools that will be coming before you. So this is sort of your last opportunity to, we're going to give you an overview of what you're going to be doing again. So some of this will be repetitive, but we thought you should have a refresher right before you dive into some of those big decisions you're going to be making. So I will turn it over to Alyssa Pearson and Brenda Bouch to walk us through this.
Before you jump off the diving board, could you tell us what you'll be giving to us and when, or is that part of your presentation?
Absolutely.
Okay, jump. Go ahead and jump or dive.
Okay. So as the commissioner said, what we want to do today is just revisit the accountability process, the clock, and the pathway options, just a refresher for you all, just so you have that fresh in your head before the March hearings start. We'll review the accountability hearings, the structures and procedures, and then through that we can talk about when you all will get materials and what materials you'll see ahead of time and what you'll need to do at which meeting. And then we just want to make sure we answer any questions that you have today about what's coming up. And again, and also say to you, if things come up over the next month, as you get materials, as you wonder about something, please feel free to reach out to us. We're here for you this month. We want you to be able to go into those March hearings as prepared as we can help you be. So just please feel free to reach out to us, and we'll do everything we can to get your questions answered. I'm going to turn it over to Brenda now to really talk through where we're at with schools and districts and the process and the timeline.
Okay, thank you. We have five districts and 12 schools that are entering the sixth year of the accountability clock on July 1st, and those are the districts and schools that will come forward before the board. It looks as of now that we will have two hearings. There's one definite confirmed hearing for March, and it's likely that we will have two hearings in March. So we would have four hearings in April and three to four in May. That is the number of lineups. I know that Busy has worked to set some dates on your calendars for a special meeting in those months so that we can get through all of these hearings. Because the statutory deadline is June 30th, 2017, So before that is when these there's 10 unique districts. So there's a total of 10 hearings. Well, up to 10, contingent upon the outcome of one of the accreditation rating hearings in March. The accountability clock process, this slide that we continue to show, just it highlights those components, and it gets at the what we will be sending you. Is part of that you'll receive the state review panel recommendation, the commissioner recommendation, and the district's proposal, because those are the key components that the state board is to take into consideration when directing action to a school or district at the end of the accountability clock. The state review panel reports were conducted last summer. We will resend that. When we send all of the materials for one school district, we'll make sure to put them all together so that you have them in one place. So we will have the state review panel reports that have already been issued, and then those commissioner recommendations will be issued in the coming weeks and prior to the hearings, and I'll get into more specifics as well in terms of timing. So this is just another overview slide.
Have you done them?
We also wanted to just do a quick run through of the pathways and get any of your remaining questions that you had around the options that are before you. The district reorganization pathway, this is just for the districts on the clock, so there are 5 districts on the clock, and this would involve changing the organization or altering the boundaries of the established districts. It does involve quite a comprehensive negotiation and a vote it requires voter approval, but it would be an option for those districts that do want to merge with another district or deconsolidate. The management pathway is an option for districts on the clock or schools on the clock. And under this pathway, the management partners come in and work with the district and the community to help support their turnaround efforts. They are expected to have some experience in turnaround, and their primary responsibility is to implement instructional, programmatic, or structural supports that result in improved student performance. And so all of their supports must, to that end, have some effect on student achievement, although that can look differently. So, for example, management partners could come in, a district could bring in a management partner to fully and comprehensively manage a school, or they may bring in a management partner just to fill a targeted need, for example, academic systems or talent management, which could be teacher recruitment. It could be the management partner could have a contract that is to, for example, manage a school for in perpetuity, or it could be contracted in a short term, a 2 to 3 year contract. So the management partnership pathway does have, it could look differently in different schools and districts that come forward to you this spring.
So I'd like to ask a question. Yeah. I looked at your rubric for management, which was another attachment. Are you filling that out for us, or do we fill that out as we're going through?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a great question. We are filling that out, and we're reviewing the plans when they're sent to us in advance.
And you're going to tell us in that process, depending on the kind of management, which questions need to be answered that are in that rubric.
That's correct. Okay. And yes, thank you. And that is contingent upon, of course, the district sending us their plan before we were to issue the commissioner's recommendation. But for example, for the district that's coming before you in March, we have filled out the rubric for their management plan, which we were able to see a draft of, and we did mark which sections of the rubric we thought were not applicable based on the nature and the structure of their management partnership. But then we didn't highlight where we felt that those key components of those rubrics that were applicable, whether or not they met them or not. And so that'll come to you.
Mm-hmm. So will we be able to encourage / require districts to be working on this prior to coming to us? Or do we run the risk of simultaneously trying to figure out with you where they are on these various questions, whether it's the innovation or the management rubric? I was trying to figure out how that's what I should do with that.
That's a good question. We are encouraging, we've been strongly encouraging districts to share drafts of their proposals with us in advance. We haven't made it a requirement. We've had our language around it has been it's optional for them to come to their hearing with a plan or to give us a plan ahead of time. I think if in the case that they don't give us one ahead of time, then that makes that hearing process more important for that vetting and to understand where they are in the partnership. And
and at some point, you know, being able to review an MOU or a draft scope of work at the very least, too, would be an important piece of evidence to see.
But that makes it kind of seat of the pants as opposed to having some time to reflect on, for you all to reflect on what they've submitted and for us. So that's I guess my question is, can we require it? I agree with you, but I don't know if we can require districts
to come ahead of
to
time.
To have a certain deadline by which they share with you and us what is what they are proposing.
I think that we could sit with Julie and ask her if there's any language that we could think about as a requirement there. So far, people have really wanted to work together and come to the table and work with us ahead of time. So I'm hopeful that that won't be too much of an issue that will get anybody coming in last minute or not coming in with anything and then scrambling.
Okay, and then in the alternative, and I'd like your comment too, in the alternative, could we say if you don't, then we're probably not going to respond to you in the same time frame. Simply because we need more time and we need another opportunity to ask you questions. I mean, some way to make this not just be by the seat of the... Sometimes on these quasi-hearings, we're just kind of getting stuff at the last minute. We're reading a couple of briefs and we're making an important decision on the basis of stuff that we haven't spent a whole lot of time digesting. And this is so important, I believe.
And I think that the way the administrative procedures are written to have the vote, the actual action taken at a subsequent meeting.
I saw that.
It's a subsequent, not the subsequent. So depending on how much preparation and how ready we are, like some districts may be very ready and you're ready to sign off on it very quickly at the very next meeting. And other districts, there might be need to be more time to develop that kind of written agreement.
Commissioner, do you have some other thoughts on that?
No, I think she covered it.
Okay. Board Member Durham?
Thank you. I think this has been very helpful and really very well put together. So you're currently engaged, Ms. Pearson, in negotiations or what you would characterize as negotiations with some of these districts and or schools. Presuming you reach agreement, does the staff then become an advocate for that position? Is that... And so we would essentially have the staff and the district on the same page?
That is our goal, if we can get to a place where we feel that the plan that is coming forward is rigorous enough to dramatically change student achievement. And if the district isn't coming there, then we can't sit at this table with them. But the goal is that we can get them there and work on that to get to that place together.
And I guess I would like to ask Dr. Anthus, do you feel that... I mean, it's an interesting, we have a quasi-judicial procedure that in theory is not adversarial. And would, on a negotiated basis, essentially, I think as a practical matter, foreclose the board from looking at other options or from successfully looking at other options? And do you feel this... this collaborative method is the best way to expose this board to all of the options and does it prevent us from exercising some judgment in what we think might be better alternatives?
Thank you, Board Member Durham. I do not think it precludes or closes any doors to the board for directing an action. I believe the statute specifically asks for a commissioner recommendation that is a part of your deliberation, but it is one part of your deliberation. So there are other parts. I believe, and I think I've told this board before, that, you know, and I know other perspectives are different, but I believe that working collaboratively with a district and being with them and going back and forth and being invited into their district and understanding the context more deeply and pushing them in that way is a better approach. So that is the approach I've been taking with the staff. Doesn't mean we haven't pushed them. Doesn't mean we haven't had tough questions, and also doesn't mean that we will agree with the district on all cases. So That's where it is. That's where the commissioner recommendation will be, but we have fully alerted our districts that the board makes this decision, and all options will be before the board.
Are you still thinking, talking, sir?
Let me think a little while.
I'll let you think. Board Member Goff.
I'm going to go back to whatever Dr. Schroeder's comment was, two or three back. How does this line up? We have two of these scheduled coming up. And, well, we have had a chance to read some of the pre-planning as part of the whole process we've already completed on this. But on the other hand, thinking in terms of having more time or possibly putting an action meeting or an action opportunity at a later date, or I'm just saying, how does that line up with our time schedules and what we're able to do in the way of communication? As far as getting more information or getting some clarification or having within ourselves, it's one thing, but I'm just wondering how we have, 4 weeks, and we have not seen, other than what we have a chance to see ahead of time, a plan, or there's really nothing concrete to consider right now from their perspective.
So
if you can help me understand how that would work,
so
and
we
keep us all within our legal boundaries.
Yep. So, absolutely. I think those are great questions. We have those slides in here to kind of talking through the timeline and the process for the procedures and all those pieces. All right. Shall we move ahead and get to that?
Thank you. And I apologize for.
No, you are fine. Clearly, that's on all your minds: is how does this actually work and how does this play out in terms of timing? So
I just want to be legal and clear.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Excuse me. Board Member Flores.
Thank you. Do the districts have the rubric?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It looks like a great rubric. And if they had a document, mm-hmm. I mean, they'd know what to write, check off.
Sorry. So I think this could be, and we have the rubric. Certainly, and the department's going to look at it first, so I'm all for the document.
Yeah, it's very helpful.
And thank you. This rubric looks great.
All right, you may move forward. I think we're
okay. Thank you.
We're with you.
Thank you for your comments. One of the last, there's three other pathways we have that are options. One is, of course, to charter one of the district-run schools, and the charter schools are semi-autonomous public schools that are currently authorized by local districts or by the Charter School Institute, and they could be proposed by either individuals or by a charter management organization. And each district does have their own way of calling for new schools, have their individual processes. So if this were to be a pathway, it would be that the state board is directing a district to open up a call for new schools, for a new charter school, and then the district would go through its process to seek out that charter provider.
Yes. Board Member Durham.
Presuming, thank you, Madam Chair, that's an option, theoretically, we want these changes implemented in the coming school year. Is that even within remotely possible to have a school out, charter school up and running in a timely fashion? Is that, I mean, based on what we've seen on charter appeals, it would appear that that's an option that's not practical, and unfortunately not practical unless pushed in some fashion. I don't quite. I'd like to have your comments on that timing.
Sure. You're correct to say that our ideal preference would be for these pathways to be in effect immediately at the start of the next school year, but we understand that certain pathways that might not be feasible and that year could be a planning year or the year when the district issues that call for new schools to identify that charter operator. Similarly, if at the very end of the hearings there were a school, at the end of the hearings, end of the hearing cycle. So if you're closer to May or June and you're issuing the closure of a school, for example, that might be a little close, cutting it close to give families time to notify. It does depend on the pathway and the situation. So we've tried to communicate to districts that will take into consideration the pathway and the local context. And we want it to be as soon as possible, but we want it to be realistic as well.
And then I guess if, let's presume let's presume they get off the clock somehow, then the action we have taken or instructed them to take wouldn't be implemented. Is that the case?
I think it's totally dependent on what the action is and the timing and where they are in the process. And I think I would just add, some districts with the charter specifically, if a district was already down that pathway or it has already taken that action because of their own district policies, things could be in place already. It's kind of how far along and how far ahead they're thinking. But yes, if you all said to a district that wasn't planning on issuing a charter to do that in May, it would be extremely challenging to open a school next school year.
Unless there's somebody standing by.
Yes. Which, yep, with location and contract and all that, but yes.
But wouldn't we also, wouldn't a magnet school be in the running for this and not just a charter? Aren't there other avenues other than privatization of a public school?
Charters are public schools, Val.
Oh, please. They're a 5034, whatever. They're under,
guys.
They're
out in the hall.
Have your fight out in the hall.
Yeah, that's just.
It's not a fight. It's just that they have their own board and such, and
they're public schools, and they it's one of the potentials,
but then a magnet school is another.
I think that would probably fall into the along the lines, and I apologize if I missed this. So we make this decision of what, but that we don't have a deadline. Or does the law include, is there anything in statute about when this change has to be made?
That's a good question.
Because like you said, I mean, if it were a charter or even reorganization,
this is what tripped us up last summer.
All of these could take an awful long time to put into place, correct?
Thanks.
Does
some,
the law
some
give
longer
us
than others.
Any deadline?
I think.
Yeah.
What?
Commissioner? Board Member Masnick and my staff can correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, you have to keep in mind that we've been working with these districts for some time now. Mm-hmm. This isn't cold for them. So as we've seen folks coming to the end of the clock, we've been preparing them to say, here are the four pathways here. Now, some of these are more drastic and would take a year planning, but in terms of, like we said earlier, they're going to come with a plan, hopefully, mm-hmm. and so they've been thinking about this. So we are hopeful that that many of them can start implementing right away.
But does the law have a deadline? Is what I'm really getting at. I mean, it just says that we can direct change, but it doesn't have a deadline for when it has to be accomplished.
Yes.
And magnet is not a.
It's not one of the four pathways.
It's not one of the four pathways. I can't believe
is
that.
Is it included in the other or other actions? Could that be included?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would depend on how a district would craft their innovation plan. Mm-hmm. They could craft, they could have that strategy within their innovation plan and articulate mm-hmm. that. So okay. there's a lot you can do in an innovation pathway.
Please continue. Thank you.
The next slides are about the innovation pathway, and the innovation pathway under the Innovation Schools Act does permit schools to seek certain waivers to achieve flexibility in hiring, scheduling, budgeting, programming, for example. And it is a pathway. So the pathway
statute references Innovation Schools Act. So the direction from the state board for a district to pursue innovation would be that that district then pursues innovation pursuant to the Innovation Schools Act. So there are, so it is just one pathway, but there are two different approval processes. So there's the approval process to get the innovation waivers according to the Innovation Schools Act, and then there's the pathway approval process whereby we determine, the state board determines whether or not it's a rigorous enough solution to achieve success in that school, so whether that school will come off the accountability clock in the next 2 years. So there are different criteria for approval, and both would occur under the, if that were to be the pathway. So there would be a, an approval of the waivers, and there would be an approval of it as a pathway through the turnaround hearing. There are, however, I did want to note that there are a couple of schools and districts that may come before you that don't need, require state waivers, so they are pursuing innovation status and they are seeking local waivers from their local school board. They're not pursuing state waivers, so that would not require, on the left-hand side of the slide, the Innovation Schools Act criteria be met, but it would still, of course, have to meet the approval of the state board in the accountability hearing. And we do have a similar rubric in place of the management rubric. We have an innovation one as well, where we've seen drafts of innovation plans and run them through our rubric, which is geared towards assessing whether or not there will be dramatic enough change as a result of that innovation plan.
Questions?
Board Member Rankin.
Correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm sure I am, but in the last couple of years, it seems like we've had a lot of schools come before us and want to be innovation schools. So if they are still on the turnaround and they come to us and say they just want to continue being innovation, that's kind of confusing to me, even if they've only been on it a year. How does that work?
In terms of your decision, if you would want to recommend that pathway?
I really haven't given them enough time to... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that essence is time, and that's where you all will need to make that judgment of, yes, they might have been approved for an innovation plan last school year. This was their first school year of implementing. They may not have come off the clock in that first year of starting to implement their innovation plan. We will fill out that rubric for the accountability pathway for them, but then it'll be up to you to decide, do you want to give them that time? Do you think it's enough?
So then we move over to the right-hand side.
Yes, absolutely.
It will be on
the right-hand side. All of our conversations about innovation as the pathway will all be under that right-hand side rubric. They may also need the left-hand side for the waivers themselves, but in terms of the decision, they could get the left-hand side, and you all could say it's not enough under the pathway. Or you could say it is enough, and we want to give them that time and see what happens.
I think when this is all said and done, we need to talk about Innovation Schools Act and see whether it shouldn't kind of rutch over to the right-hand side anyway. Yeah. Yes, please continue.
If a district can grant their own waivers, do they look like our waivers? What type of a waiver would a district give?
Yeah, they can do anything.
They can do almost
from their policies.
This is Kelly Rosensweet, and she is in charge of the left-hand.
So your question about the waivers, most of the waivers mirror the state waivers that are granted, truthfully, and maybe Julie's better suited to answer why they would both necessarily be needed, but in many cases when a local policy exists, for example, one of the common ones innovation schools seek is for things around time and calendar. They'll extend their school day, they'll extend their school year. So they'll waive the local policy, which is to allow them to set their own calendar, and then they'll waive the state one that indicates they set their own calendar that meets or exceeds the state statute. I don't know if we want to, why that, yeah, okay. there's also, at the state level, the licensing waiver is a big one for both charter and innovation, are seeking that right now, and that one allows them to hire staff that meet the bar for hire, previously highly qualified, yeah.
Local district level too.
That one would require the state waiver over the local waiver for that. The other piece is the evaluation waiver that ties to Senate Bill 191. That would be a state statute they'd waive rather than a local policy. They could waive the local tool that that district's using, but to really implement their own evaluation, they would also need the state one with that.
Thank you.
Board Member Goff.
Well, last time I asked a little bit more about the front end. What about the back end? Let's say, I think with charters it seems a little more clear cut that if a school is goes into a charter situation, I would assume that time frames are attached to the contract that's developed. So there would be a minimum, at least, minimum amount of time for the charter to be in existence and try it. But if it's not a charter or a magnet or some other structure, let's say there was a district or a school who did magically pull a miracle off. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, realistically, I'd say 2 years. If they are off the clock by then, is there an opening for them to say, you know, we're going to go back on our own, we're going to pick up the traditional path that we're on, or not? Or is there? Do we have prerogative? Does the department have a prerogative to say this needs to be in place and tried, a fair trial of a minimum of so much time? Would it be tied possibly to our accountability timelines? I'm thinking at the other end of this.
I mean, what's specific in statute right now is just the timeline at the end of the clock, at the end of those 5 years, and that's right. What statute really lays out. Do you want to?
For charter and innovation, statute already dictates a timeline. So right. The charter school would have a term with their right. authorizer, and that would dictate performance of the annual review and then a renewal. For an innovation school, there's also a term associated with that. It's 3 years. But it is only at the local level.
Right. Thank you. Because that's kind of what I guess my question really is. We're in this part, but do we have any, whether you call it responsibility or prerogative, to determine the timelines? Because I don't know that districts, I'm sure they could work that out, but I'm not sure they should have to do everything. I'm just wondering where are the consequences sitting? At what level? Who's got the job?
In terms of the accountability clock, what we have specific language about is just right now at the end of the 5 years, and that's what the language in the law covers.
Okay. So
Julian, what is there? Am I missing anything?
No,
okay.
You
okay.
Board Member Mazin?
So can you explain for schools and districts that got innovation status, did that stop the clock for them if they were on the clock? Mm-mm. Still the same.
No, still the same.
Clarity. Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay, proceed. I'm not sure anymore who's presenting.
We have a little bit.
Just one last slide on school closure as a pathway, and just to remind you of the different options under this pathway that a school could choose to close part of its school, so certain grades. So, for example, if a school serves grades 6 through 12, it could choose to close grades 6 through 8, and that would be considered school closure by the department's school closure guidelines and the definition of school closure. So that could be a situation that comes before you as well. And the other full closure, of course, is an option. And then in terms of how the school is closed, it could be an immediate closure or could be a phase out where the school doesn't accept students of a certain grade. So, for example, they don't enroll those sixth graders, and then the next year they don't enroll seventh, next year they don't enroll eighth, so then they're a 9th through 12th school. So there's a little bit of nuance in the school closure pathway that I just wanted to point out.
Right. Board Member Flores. I'd like you put on the table that they districts could actually come together.
You mean merge?
Oh, the district
merging of districts. And so this would be something that they've already talked out. I mean, meaning districts merging together. This is something that they would come, or would this be something that?
It's very complicated.
Well, no, I'm sure
because you have to have a vote of the
of the community, but then.
The community or the whole state?
Community.
When we went from 176 to 178, we all voted on it.
But that was for the district. That was the
that was for a couple of spin-offs.
No, but I mean
mean, wasn't
this is the opposite. This is consolidating districts.
Wasn't that district made out of charters? Wasn't that the charter
district?
No.
This is before charters. This happened before charters. And I thought there was had to be a statewide vote. Am I wrong?
Totally.
If my memory
it's
just
a local
shot.
Vote.
I think she's talking about consolidation
when we
of school districts.
When we changed, I think we added two districts. There were two districts that split from 100, so we went from 176 to 178, and I thought we all had to vote on that. It was a sort of a silly thing.
Yeah. You know what? I don't know the answer.
You weren't here either.
I was not here.
I was only half here. Technically, I mean, I went and I voted, but I wasn't as involved in school issues. Anyway, it's complicated to either merge or split up. It's not just we all agree we want to do this.
Right.
Especially if there are bonds you have to allocate, bond payments. And
yep.
It really gets complicated. Yep.
So are we sure that there are no districts that will come to us and say, we want to merge?
I'm not aware of any at this time.
Okay.
What about guarantee it.
What about a district that wants to break up, like Denver, into four areas?
I want to break up with you.
That takes a constitutional amendment, I think, to be voted on by all the states.
Jeffco had that. I mean, there's been that discussion with Jeffco for many years.
Denver's under Article 20 in the state constitution. They're created as a city, county, and school district. So I think that would require a statewide vote if they wanted to break up.
Anyway, anywho,
okay.
Yep.
I think. I mean, always ask our legal counsel about Article 20.
Well, you know it.
Madam Pearson, are you next?
I think Board Member Mazanek had a question.
Oops.
Did you want us to explain the phase out a little bit better? Or again?
The phase out?
The phase out where the school.
I was interested when you said it could be partial closure. And partial closure, it looks like it could
be incredibly difficult.
Quite open-ended. Quite.
Yeah. So partial and phase out would be two different things. So partial is if you might have two grade spans in a school, like a 6 through 12, a middle school and a high school, and you look at the data and one of the grade spans is not performing well and they really want to focus on the other, so you could partially close one of them. Phase out would be where the school slowly closes over time because, part of what we've been thinking about with this is how do you ensure kids, we make sure kids have a good place to go to. And so for some communities, it may make sense to phase the school out instead of just close right off. So then you just don't take new kids in. Yeah.
We just had a few slides on the procedures around the hearings that will be coming up and what you will receive in advance. So you will receive three items at least in advance, and that will include the state review panel recommendation, the commissioner recommendation, and the district's report or proposal if they're submitting that. So those three items at a minimum will be submitted. You may also receive additional documentation as well. We're trying to make sure that what we send you is relevant and helpful to the hearings, but those are definitely going to be part of that packet, and we are aiming to get those to you all at least 30 days prior to the hearing in most instances. The March meeting, there is, as I said, there's one confirmed hearing. There's another that will likely happen as well. But for the confirmed hearing, you will receive those materials, I believe, on Friday. Busy and I will work to get you those either Friday or Monday. So they will be coming imminently, and that will include those three elements. The district has submitted a management proposal, so we will send that over along with the state review panel report and the commissioner's recommendation, and that will give you a little under the 4 weeks to review prior to the March hearing.
And the filled out rubric?
And the filled out rubric.
Okay.
Yes. And the filled out rubric is embedded in the commissioner's recommendation, so it's included attached to that.
Good. Okay.
And then at the hearing, there's an opportunity for the department to present on behalf of the commissioner for the commissioner's recommendation, and the district will have an opportunity to present its plan and proposal, and then the state board has the opportunity to present or to engage in questions and discussions. So that 30 minutes where the district is presenting in particular is meant to be an uninterrupted time for the district to give a presentation, and then there is
time
afterwards.
So we may interact with those folks in our two-hour time period.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah,
yes.
I think we're going to like that a lot better.
Thank you, guys.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank
yeah,
you.
That's it.
Yeah, the only thing I don't like is the district report optional. I want to see that optional go away.
Well, we can share that sentiment with the districts as we talk with them, that the board would like, board chair would be very amenable to seeing your plan ahead
of
time.
She might be grumpy otherwise.
Okay. Uh-huh. We will happily share that.
My goodness.
We are very close to finalizing the full schedule for all of the hearings, and Busy is working to get out formal scheduling notifications to all 10 districts within the next week so that we will have, so we are very, very close to getting everybody scheduled in, and then that way we can send out their materials in advance, and so it'll be this rolling sending of materials. You'll be constantly receiving materials from us over the next 3 months, but hopefully in enough advance time so that you can review those prior to the hearing.
And then at that first hearing, you all, there's no vote required of you then. At the administrative procedures, it's really at that subsequent meeting. So you'll have the time to review the materials ahead of time, then to hear from the districts and ask them questions, and then there's some time to process before you make a final decision.
Okay.
There's time.
Board Member Durham.
Thank you. I believe we'll question. Board Member.
Death by hanging.
Get her out.
I won.
She said death by hanging.
When it does come before the board, since you missed the judicial proceeding.
You know, that's an interesting question. Since we're treating it, we're requiring written submissions in advance, so obviously they can familiarize themselves with the materials that are going to support the positions of both parties. You know, I'd like to take a look. My instinct, though, is that they could vote as long as they could provide some assurance that they've become familiar with the materials that are submitted to guide the deliberations. The other option is, too, I don't know, our live streaming is also recorded, is that
mm-hmm.
right as well? So that would present an opportunity. But the main thing is that all the board members are supposed to be drawing from the same knowledge base in connection with voting. But since
you might be able to listen to the tape.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably a good idea to know the answer, just in case something
never happened with this crowd, but I'll take a look. That's what I'm going to worry about, frankly.
Board Member
Rankin,
Masnick, sorry.
And so we have the hearing, and then we can consider proposed written determinations.
Yes. So at the conclusion of the hearing,
explain what those are, and then when we vote, what I'm wondering, will there be question? Will there be opportunity for question and answer then, or is at the end of the hearing, and then like a judge or a jury, then we deliberate until, or do we get to ask more questions?
We get to ask questions that day.
I know.
And I think your question
after
is,
that.
Do we get to come up with some more questions in the interval between that hearing and the next meeting when we vote?
And who could those questions be directed to? Would it be just our own staff, or would the school or district?
Madam Chair and Ms. Masnick said the model is, it's sort of been developed, and obviously we're kind of creating the wheel as we're driving,
mm-hmm.
right? Because we don't have a good roadmap for this, but envisions that you have a hearing, and then at the end of it, it's closed, time's up,
right.
And that deliberation is truly just deliberation among the board. If there were a reason that you wanted to reinitiate a conversation, I think it would require reopening the hearing, and you need to be sure that both sides were present.
Yeah.
So obviously best and cleanest practice will be not to go there if you can help it.
Right. Okay. Just want to make sure I understand how it works.
Board Member Rankin?
No, I got it right. On page 16, that prior to the hearing, the state board will receive the review panel recommendation, commissioner recommendation, and the district report if they have one. Except for number three, is there someone at CDE that we will have a name after each one of those that if we have a question about that process or about what came in that we can call and ask?
Absolutely. Yeah. We'll make sure you know who to, you send your questions. to busy shields.
It's just a quick question.
Yes, absolutely, and we know that you probably will when you see the materials or want to know terminology or anything like that.
Yeah, ask him not to use acronyms, please.
We're working very hard to make sure we don't.
Thank you.
We'll go back and comb through it. I usually read for that, but I will go back. We'll do a last once over.
Thank you.
But even then, there may be things you have questions about, so just as always, let us know.
Any other questions?
I do have one, just comment.
Board Member Goff.
It may not be directly germane to this. Our board operating procedures do have language in them about voting electronically or when you're not present and so forth. And what it says, I'll paraphrase, it has language in it that says a board member need not be present in the room, but in order to vote, which would be, you know, on the phone or by some kind of hookup, you need to have heard the issue at hand. So whether that means live or by tape, unclear, but we might want to just kind of look at that and see what, if that's something that could transfer and apply. I don't think it's going to happen. I'm going to predict. I wouldn't be real happy if we had plural board members absent on the day that we were due to vote on this.
I doubt any of us would feel
in the room or
right?
Not. I know. That's why I don't think it's. I hope it's not going to happen.
Chair.
I don't think.
Board Member Durham.
Yeah, I'm not as concerned about being absent on the day of the vote as I am in absent the day of the hearing, which is, draws the other question. I would presume if we were present, if we were completely absent, obviously you can't vote. If you're present by electronics, probably you can. At least we've allowed that in the past.
Mm-hmm. Finish up.
I believe that's all.
I want you to get to the picture. And how do you guys decide on these pictures?
That is so
perfect.
Yeah.
You guys start putting Grayson up there.
I know.
So we should stop those.
I wondered what
that's what we should do.
I have cuter pictures.
This is kind of turnaround.
Send them to
right? This kid's going
to
turn around.
Yeah, yes. Much.
Upside down.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And just please let us know what during the next month and beyond, but especially during the next month as we get ready for the first one or two, let us know what we can do to help you. So.
Thank you.
Okay. So we didn't talk about the rubrics, but they're so detailed.
Are you saying Pam?
Oh. Next item on the agenda is a legislative update. I believe we saw Mrs. Mello sneak in here. Do we want to? Yeah, let's have a discussion first, please. Oh, and where is that thing? Hey, this is the bag. Did Steve get to look at it? Or did it start there?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Madam Chair, State Board, good morning, or good afternoon, I suppose. It's been the kind of day at the Capitol where I'm not quite sure what time it is, to be quite honest with you.
It is 4 to 4, my dear. We're early.
And I just got a text from Busy saying, great, we're almost there. So technology is a little behind. So as we head into February, obviously the pace picks up quite a bit over at the legislature. Bills are moving through, I guess, depends on your definition of quickly, but committees are very busy, you know, giving bills their first hearings. A lot of bills go down in those first hearings. So in some ways, the bills we're looking at start to winnow. However, new bills are still being introduced every day. So in other ways, the bills we have to look at are widening. The main item of business today is that the ledge contacts are recommending an opposed position, that the board take an opposed position on Senate Bill 114. This is a bill by Senator Dominic Moreno. And it has to do with the accountability system. And because those details are complex and they matter, Alyssa is going to explain them to you so we make sure we get this right.
As well as I can today. So there's three main components of this bill. One is adding another performance indicator, which looks at improvement in achievement and growth and for disaggregated groups over a period of 4 years. So kind of saying where you are 4 years ago, where you are today, what was that improvement, and adding that as a performance indicator.
In addition to the growth.
In addition to already having growth and already having achievement and already having post-secondary workforce readiness. The way it's written, we've been trying to work on interpreting it. The way it's written is pretty specific, and we're concerned that until we have 4 years of consistent data, meaning same assessment, same results, we're not sure we could implement something like that. So there's just some technical pieces to it that may be some challenges. The second part of the bill says that growth needs to be weighed the most in the performance frameworks when you do all the summative. You all have board rules. The law has never said anything about the weighting. In your board rules, you all have said growth and post-secondary workforce readiness need to be weighed the most. So I don't know. I think they probably could work together. We would need to dig in if the bill passed. But I just wanted to highlight that that was in there. And then the last part is around the accountability clock, what we were just talking about. It. And what it does, it removes the board's authority to remove accreditation based on performance. There's still the ability for the board to remove accreditation if it's about financial concerns, and that language isn't still in there. But if it's about a performance in terms of the clock, the board's authority to do that, either that they must or may, is gone from the law. Instead, it says the board needs to direct a corrective action. And that corrective action, the list of corrective actions, is exactly what's in law right now, but it's just called a corrective action. And so that's really kind of the switch there. And it talks about an appeal hearing for schools and districts. We think that kind of works already with the administrative procedures that are in there. We're assuming that it's just that chance for the district to talk to the board about the action, what the corrective action would be.
So, Board Member Flores.
Thank you.
So what are they thinking? What is... Senator Moreno thinking of that other option? I mean, I can think of lots of options, but specifically, what are some of the options that he and others are thinking about for the first one?
Madam Chair, Dr. Flores, and obviously I want to let Alyssa speak to that. I mean, I have not spoken with Senator Moreno in detail about this bill, and nothing we say I don't think could be representative of his thinking. So, but you go ahead and if you have an answer.
Were you speaking specifically about the end of the clock options, or?
Well, I'm speaking specifically about other options other than the growth and.
Oh, that other indicator?
Okay, and then I have a second question.
So the indicator, it's very specific in the language in this draft bill around it's adding this indicator of improvement. So looking at the change over 4 years, what your achievement rating or your achievement data, your actual score changes over 4 years, and having that be a measure, what your growth change over 4 years, what your disaggregated groups have done in achievement and growth over right. 4 years.
Well, I know we have that. I have some issues with growth, especially when growth is so small. But I'm concerned also about accreditation, because I think that is kind of something he did last year, and I was at the hearing on accreditation where I was really concerned about whether a university would take children. I know that he was trying to get accreditation for the state, but what about if they went out of state? And out of state, if we took accreditation away, then sometimes those universities will not take kids who do not come from an accredited school. So that's we're talking about a serious issue for kids who might have a scholarship outside or outside the state. And I don't know if UC or University of Colorado any of them would take a student without, and that comes from a school that's not accredited. So, I mean, that's a serious issue for students.
Madam Chair and Dr. Flores, so I mean, there certainly has been discussion about this topic before in the legislature. What Alyssa just informed me is that your ability under current law is to remove accreditation from a district, not from a school. And as long as the school remains accredited, the issues that you're flagging, Dr. Flores, and I think there have been lots of questions about this, so I certainly understand where you're coming from. But it's only if a school were to lose its accreditation that the students might suffer those consequences that you were describing. So the district losing its accreditation.
Districts accredit the schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't.
Yeah. Correct. That's my understanding.
Yeah. Well, isn't there an outside accreditation agency that accredits, or do we?
Districts can do that if they
want. Yeah. Districts accredit their schools. We accredit their the districts mm-hmm. only. This is a change over
it's
time.
Universities were an accrediting agency
right,
outside.
Right, right. Yeah. We used to have all sorts of accrediting
okay.
of schools that no longer, right. especially high schools, that no longer
accreditation is a serious issue.
Oh, my apologies. Board Member McCall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do I understand correctly that in a district that has lost its accreditation is still empowered to accredit, give accreditation to its individual schools?
I think this is an area is uncharted territory, right? We have never, at least in my knowledge of the history of where the state and the ed reform history has gone, we haven't removed a district's accreditation before. So I think there's things to figure out. I don't know if Julie has anything that she wants to add. We've been digging through what really happens if accreditation is removed.
I cannot speak for Senator Moreno, but I wonder if we may have uncovered perhaps an element of his thinking. Maybe he may be worried about what could happen if a district loses its accreditation and then wondering what the waterfall effect is for the students within that district in terms of their ability to feel safe in knowing that they will go forward with accreditation.
And I will just point out that Senator Moreno, I believe, has two districts that are at the end of the clock in his district, Westminster and Adams 14. It's not a theoretical issue for him. I mean, it's something that's happening in his legislative district.
And I think the concern has been, and I believe the understanding has been, the concern about students and students having the ability to get scholarships and go to college, and mm-hmm. that was part of the concern in the past. I believe where it landed was that the district's removal of accreditation shouldn't threaten any of that, but we can go back and track down. I don't know if Tony had that. Somebody had done some research. Because there was that concern that I think most people share about students being in this position where maybe they wouldn't be eligible for scholarships or able to get into college if they had, you know, if they met the entrance requirements.
As a practical matter, unless I'm mistaken, as we have had these discussions over the last probably 3 years about the consequences of the clock, our concerns about removing accreditation were for districts that just went, and we're going to ignore the fact that they were on the 5-year clock and didn't give a darn. And I don't see that kind of behavior on the part of any of them. I mean, maybe I'll be surprised that there's going to be a district that just simply doesn't care and says, do to us what you want to, as opposed to we're going to try this, this, and this to improve outcomes for kids. So this was sort of a threat that we just don't really expect to come forward.
We're hoping not. We're hoping to have everybody engaged and caring about the outcomes for kids and ready to take a pathway forward so that we don't need to. But currently, you all do have that ability if it gets to a point where somebody isn't or moving fast enough that you could remove accreditation.
Board Member McClellan.
Thank you. This is just a quick follow-on to my line of questions. I think before proceeding with a vote, I would want to feel sure rather than leaving those students in limbo to hope that we would not take the action. I would want to know if the district, if it were to lose its accreditation, would those students find themselves in a compromised position? Because you could have an A student who's worked hard for their entire academic career and have their future compromised if I don't know for sure the answer to that question, and if indeed the bill fails and they go unprotected. So although we may think it might be unlikely that we would go down that road, I would want to responsibly know before I vote on whether or not to support this.
Oh, sorry.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. That's not all this bill does. And, you know, I think it's designed, if it passes, to try and get two districts off the clock.
Yeah.
Because it not only does it deal with the accreditation question, it also deals with adding an additional factor. So it shouldn't be any mistake about what the motive is. And I would suspect that the school district involved had something to do with suggesting this bill might be a good idea. If this bill passes, I think we probably just ought not to have any of these hearings on the schools on the clock, because it's a clear demonstration that the legislature is not serious about accountability. And if we don't keep all of the options available to us, I think it's a clear demonstration that this board is not serious about accountability. So it may be appropriate to use the accreditation option. It may not. And it may have dire consequences to people. That's kind of the idea. The students in these schools have already faced a dire consequence of a failing school for 6 years. And that's the backdrop against which you have to judge how draconian any action this board may take is. Because you have to start with the premise that you've had a bad result for a significant period of time, and our decision is, are we going to let that go on or not? Now, I'm not overly optimistic that this is going to be as successful a process as it ought to be, but if we want to let the legislature pass this bill, fine, but I think we should in no uncertain terms make it clear to them that we're wasting our time with accountability and they're wasting their time pretending that we have accountability.
I just want to ask another question on this.
Board Member Flores.
And it has to do with accountability. Don't school districts have various measures that they can use, local measures that they can use for accountability other than a score on PARC and the teacher? Aren't there others? Are there multiple ways of being able to?
So through the request to reconsider process that we just wrapped up, districts can submit additional information for performance data for schools or districts. The guidance we have is pretty specific that information can supplement the state assessment data but not supplant it. So we really pay attention to that achievement data in K-2 where we don't have statewide data, growth data in K-3, the areas where we don't have state assessment. But it's not automatic, it's through a review process, and it's really looked as supplemental to the state assessment data.
And then what if some of us feel that or think that the test that we're currently using is not...
Oh, it's really late in the day.
Well,
so could I have a motion, please? Can we have a motion,
excuse
please?
Excuse me, I want to finish my sentence. It's not sufficient to...
It's a different conversation.
Well,
we need to
really
look at
test.
This bill.
But that's going to be in play, I think, when we make decisions such as this.
I have a motion, please.
Whether that test is really credible.
Board Member Rankin.
I move to oppose Senate Bill 17-114.
Second.
Okay. Thank you. Please go right ahead. Board Member McClellan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it possible that in the event that a district lost its accreditation, would the schools in question, in the event that they are not granted accreditation by their district, if they don't have that authority, would they then come before us? Is there still a mechanism by which those schools would be gauged individually?
So those schools receive a plan type from the state that's based on, you know, our school performance framework. So there's a way of us, there's a way for the department to describe the performance of students in those schools.
And I guess if you don't mind, I just want to make sure that we're really clear in terms of what you all are voting on right now and what the bill does. So the bill would remove that as an option for the board. It certainly does not require you to use that as an option. And I'm hearing that some of you have questions about that. Right now, it is an option you can use. If this bill were to pass in its current form, it would not be an option you could use to remove district accreditation. So just wanted to make sure that
Wanted to make sure that there was still a pathway by which the individual schools in a district that has lost accreditation still have a pathway themselves to achieve accreditation. Are we fairly certain the answer to that is yes?
That the school would have
a pathway toward accreditation.
District loss of accreditation.
I don't think we know this.
I know that we will describe their performance. I know that the department's responsible for assigning a school plan type for that school.
So the loss of a district's accreditation does not automatically take away accreditation for the individual schools.
There's nothing in state law that says that. Is there, Julie? I mean, we haven't.
No, and that's where I think the statute is difficult, because accreditation, you know, we think of it in this higher ed context, almost, oh, your degree's from an unaccredited institution, so you can't get certain kinds of jobs. This is really a different animal. I mean, it's not about an impact for students so much as the biggest thing that makes it a real nuclear option is that if you remove accreditation, it triggers the School District Reorganization Act. I mean, it makes that entire district, its process, its staffing, its boundaries, its everything is all of a sudden up for grabs in forming a committee, having an election, all of those things that school district reorganization involves. And that makes conceptual sense, right? If a district's chronically underperforming, eventually you have to say the entire system has to be blown up and we're going to start over. And that's what the statute envisions. But in terms of consequences for students, we have not identified a way in which it does what we all kind of keep thinking it sounds like it should do. So, but one of the reasons I think probably it's so important to maintain at least the option is because if a district were so underperforming and perhaps intransigent, as Mr. Durham described, to have the option to say somebody else needs to be responsible for those kids because the system that's in place isn't working.
But removal of a district's accreditation does not necessarily remove accreditation from the schools within the district?
Schools don't even really have accreditation. That's why it's so odd. Accreditation is a district concept.
But if it's not a statewide.
If a student comes from that district, I mean, and if the district is not accredited, so it places a big onus on the student who is graduating from that district going on to university. And
that's been the piece that's been so hard for us to sort of wrap our hands around, because there's not a statute that ties district accreditation to outcomes for students.
Right.
Or status of students.
Right. But a school, the University of Alabama or the University of Illinois, mm-hmm. I mean, will yes. they just take that and say, oh,
Steve said,
Colorado hasn't figured that out, so we're just going to pass on that student that came from a district that's not accredited?
I don't think that's what they're looking. They're looking at the test scores, they're looking at the transcript, and they're looking at the essay, if I'm not mistaken. That's
it's
what higher
accreditation
ed. I don't know if they actually even check to see whether a high school is accredited. Can we call
I
the vote?
Do.
Are we ready?
Whoops. Just one sentence.
Board member, go.
Thank you.
Goff. I just bit down on my.
How long have I known?
So sorry.
Now you made me forget.
There's nothing, one of the points I think is there's nothing in this bill, and there's not, every other bill is sort of silent on that whole issue. So until there's something in a bill that we can talk about, it's not there. So we have questions, it's not there. The other thing too, I don't normally look at for this right off. There is no end date, there's no effective date, there's no, that I can see, Jennifer, maybe you've noticed it somewhere. There's no year where this would take effect. So we're, the way it looks, we're talking about.
Madam Chair,
it has a safety
the bill
clause.
Has a safety clause.
Effective immediately upon signature.
So as soon as the bill passes and the governor signs it, it goes into effect. That's what a safety clause
that,
does.
For practical purposes, that means, next school year?
No,
what?
The day it's signed.
Now?
If this bill were to pass and be signed on April 1st, then the schools could all demand another accountability measure in as to whether or not they're failing schools, and they could and we would not be able to remove accreditation.
We could save ourselves a lot of time.
Well, and that's.
We ready to call the vote, guys?
Yeah, that's okay with me.
Ms. Cordial.
I'm going to be playing
Board Member Durham.
Clarify the motion is to oppose the bill.
Oppose.
Yes.
Board Member Flores.
Yes.
Board Member Goff.
Yes.
Board Member Masnack?
Yes.
Board Member McClellan?
No.
Board Member Rankin?
Yes.
And Board Member Schroeder?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Back to me. So that was the most pressing piece of business from a legislative perspective. We will continue this process and continue to bring bills to you as the legislative context, review them, and recommend a position. I just would remind you that, and we try to send this link out in every weekly report we do, in every agenda we do, in everywhere we can, and you only need the link once. But if you ever want to check on what education bills are out there and what their status is, that link will help you do it. I'm, of course, always happy to answer your questions, but if you ever or read the bill or read the fiscal note, all of that information is contained within that link that we send you. And then I just thought I would answer, and if anyone had any questions about any specific proposals moving through, I'm happy to answer them.
We've been here all day. Has anything happened over there today?
Madam Chair, Board Member Goff, not on education. Nothing happened on education. I will say, in terms of legislation, Joyce Sierkowski gave a presentation to the Joint House and Senate Education Committees this morning on assessment. This was kind of part of a series of presentations that the committees had requested from the department. Ms. Pearson did one on accountability about 3 weeks ago. Ms. Colesman did one on standards a couple of weeks ago. And then Mr. Sierkowski finished up that process today. It was very well received. The committees have found them to be just very informative and helpful as they think about policy. Great. Thank you.
I'm 20.01, Legislative Priorities. Board members Rankin and Goff, would you like to share with us your draft? And somebody make a motion.
Can you start?
At the last meeting, I asked if I could be a part of the revision of the legislative priorities. Board Member Flores and Board Member Goff also wanted to be a part of it. Started out, I rewrote them, and then we discussed at the first meeting. After that, Board Member Flores sent a revision of her own or things she wanted to have continued, and Board Member Goff also had some input that she sent electronically. And Ms. Cordial put those together in a new iteration, and Board Member Goff and I sat down and looked at our three plus the revision and made some additional changes. We believe we came up with a document that includes everything, or in some form, every idea that came across. And together we just produced a document that you see today, and we would like to have it approved. There may be some questions from board members, but that was the process we used.
Ms. Goff, any more comments?
No, not really. Parts of this, the language is maintains what has been in previous years' priorities documents, slight modifications in some places. One thing that is different, we added a, I guess what you would call a little preamble or an intro paragraph that kind of introduces the notions that built upon. And the last one, the one under State Board Authority, that has also been a part of the priorities from the past several years. Slightly reworded, but not really that much to change any substance from what it has been. There are parts of that that I've been looking at, and I just wanted to, I won't say anything in case anybody else wants to talk about that last paragraph. It's really a way to maintain in our priorities. Basically, it's the notion of separation of powers. There are some things that are state board authorized that we would want to preserve and protect, so to speak. But that our authority statement is one way to just put that out again, that that's there are some things that are definitely within our realm, our purview, and we work with them all the time. We are on one or more of them at any given moment. So that's what the purpose of that last part is. And the first one, the first paragraph, categories are, again, like Joyce said, there are some general areas that are of not only timely interest and work related, but they also really do sum up pretty much all of the highlights of what we are about. I will tell you, there is really no presence of the word legislation in any of this, and policy is used more in the general sense of policymakers, which we are, and policymakers who are across the street. And this is policy. This is a way of carrying out goals, of carrying out the important values that we think are part of our work and are part of our state and are important to us. So you'll see policy that supports or policy that ensures. That was the rationale there. So.
Board Member Flores.
Thank you. I like it. I also think in that state board authority, we should have parents somewhere. I mean, parents are not mentioned. And they're mentioned up here.
They're in the document.
But and state board authority, I mean, we mentioned nonprofits. Mm-hmm. We should have parents in there as well. Because they're the public, and parents, they represent children.
State board authority, you want them mentioned. Is that what you're
saying?
That's
right. Okay. I think somewhere there, I mean, we mentioned nonprofit organizations.
Yeah. Can we don't actually, maybe it would help if you give me 1 second to talk about that paragraph and where we may want to look at rewording. State board authority, is that... This is really those duties and powers and responsibility that are outlined in statute.
Well, and I'm just saying through collaboration.
Well, that's what I would like to propose. I'll give you something to think about, and then we can come back here. Rather than keeping that whole first sentence there, the essence of state board authority is that the board is responsible for the general supervision of public schools. That's in the statute. That's what the books say.
Right.
So that sentence could end there. That would take out any reference to legislative or the other parts of what goes on. And then continue down with, in furtherance of our constitutional responsibility, we support policy that recognizes our rulemaking authority. So the whole point of that part is to reinforce or remind that our authority is this part of it, and that we operate through rulemaking authority, not through legislation. We work through legislation. We are not the producers.
Okay. So you would be, you would not be opposed to keeping the first sentence, and the last sentence in there.
Yeah, I'm thinking. I mean that. Right now, my thoughts are that it limits it to authority.
Okay.
It doesn't add anything else, you know, people could think. Okay. And we do all those things in collaboration. And there are some others that could be added there. But is it or is it not important to the point being that the state board has specific duties and obligations and powers?
Well, that sounds fine to me. I don't know about other members, but I would like to suggest that for choice and engagement, that we have ensures students have high quality instead of every student, and I know why every student, but there may be a student out there when we put every, ensures students have high quality educational choices to best meet their individual learning needs and aspirations instead of ensures every student. And we mean it because we're saying
that students now have high quality educational choices to meet their individual learning needs and aspirations. We did the same for parents. We didn't say ensures every parent has access to.
So I think semantics, grammatical.
I think so. Yes. And then the next one would be and under choice and engagement, the last point, ensures local options to further support their public schools are preserved. And if charters, I mean, the argument is charters are public. Using your
schools
argument, then
that's just one argument.
And then so you wouldn't, I don't see any, how anybody could say we shouldn't put public in there, because that keeps it away from, you know, others who may not be under the rubric of public, which is charter and public. So we need to add public.
Board Member Masnick.
I move we approve these legislative priorities.
Could I have a second, please?
I said second.
We could get this off of our list.
Well, but I mean,
any other comments?
There's nothing really offensive.
Board Member Durham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have an amendment to the motion for approval, which is in the last paragraph on page 2, second sentence. Insert a period after the word branches. Strike the balance of that sentence. That removes nonprofits and private sector from the specific list. I could bore you all with my pejorative views of nonprofits, but
yeah,
I think we'll just put it up for a vote and go from there. Yeah.
Colleagues, I don't disagree. You get half of your pejorative.
You're what?
I'll give you half of your pejorative.
Okay.
So what about the others?
Should we call the vote?
On the amendment?
Yes.
Yeah, the amendment.
And then approve with the amendment?
Just one moment, please.
More than one amendment can be offered if you have your own.
I do. I had those.
Okay, wait, let's just vote on this one, please.
But you have to dispose of this one first.
And just for clarification for myself, are we including the changes that Board Member Flores also had suggested?
Right now we're just working on the amendment that was presented by Board Member Durham, which means it stops at the word branches.
Yes.
Strike the balance of the sentence.
Yes.
Strike the balance of the sentence, but not the following sentence.
Not the following sentence, that is correct.
Correct.
Is that right?
And then can we go back?
May we just finish this?
No, please. I need to say what I'm going to say.
We need to take a vote.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Board Member Goff.
I just want to say, are we going to hurt someone's feelings if we leave out judicial?
Ooh.
I hadn't really thought about it, but as a practical matter, I don't think we collaborate with them.
We don't like to.
We don't.
We probably want to minimize our interaction.
Boy, we have really been after you today, haven't we?
Thank you.
Well, she's part of the executive branch.
Yeah,
so,
that's true.
So she's covered.
Hurry, busy, call the roll.
All right. Can we call the vote, please?
Board Member Durham.
Yes.
Board Member Flores.
Okay.
Yes.
Board Member Goff.
Yes.
Board Member Masnick.
Yes.
Board Member McClellan.
Yes.
Board Member Rinkin.
Yes.
And Board Member Schroeder.
Yes.
What do you know?
Okay. Board Member Flores, go for it.
I move to make those changes that I mentioned before, which is on the choice engagement section, to have ensures
every student?
Ensure students, not everybody, but ensure students, just to go along with, with
the rest.
Is this
an additional bullet point?
It's to extract every.
Pardon me?
It's striking through
after
ensures every student has and makes it ensure students have, so that it aligns with the second bullet, ensures parents have.
It needs to align, if I may say so, with the intro phrase above it. If we're going to keep that, policies in the plural, we support policies that So then you say ensure students.
Well, no. I haven't finished yet. There's a second, ensures local options to further support.
Public.
Their public schools are preserved.
Yeah, we'll just grammatically align the whole thing.
Okay.
I think I understand what you're
pointing. But I'm adding public.
Yes, I got it.
Okay.
I'm sorry, where's the public down there?
The last bullet.
Ensures, in choice and engagement, the last point.
Yeah.
To further support their public schools, or to further support public schools are preserved.
To further support public
schools. That public schools are preserved. And then Jane, you continue.
That's all. I think.
Is there a second to her motion?
Oh, I'll second.
Okay.
Any comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm
Board Member Durham.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
I know how it feels. I think as a practical matter, although I'm not Catholic, I'm not sure I want to upset the Archbishop. And I think the schools, public and private, while we have very limited authority over non-public schools, we do actually have some occasionally, and I don't think they should be excluded. So they also don't need to be specifically referenced. So I think that it's a very neutral way that the thing that it's been drafted in the first place.
Leave it schools?
Leave it just schools. Leave it schools. Just schools.
So now what is the motion?
I'll sever her motion to separate out. I'll move to sever or request to sever and to vote on each half of the motion separately.
Given that you put it that way, we do have some public schools. I mean, some private schools. But that's kind of a hard one, because we don't oversee private schools.
Correct.
So I think adding the public there just makes it
this is
we support I mean, public schools.
This is not it's hard to it's almost like resolution in that it's stating beliefs, values. And so the general topic here is choice and engagement. We are choice supporters. We want engagement. We want both of them. That's great. So right. I'm thinking that the general is fine. It's not a matter of strictly overseeing. We do interact with, and we do, you know, we just support schools. We support schools, and we support choice, and we want people to be engaged. And I think anyone
so we go for the with the semantic
who's reading this will take it as
the semantic and not the public.
I think the generic rather than the specific.
Okay.
I don't think that public schools will be in danger of not being supported
not
by this board
engaged.
If we don't say public.
Oh.
Okay.
Ms. Cordial, could you read back what it is that we
So now it's just the students,
so
right?
Yes.
We're down to just students.
Mm-hmm. And we're not going to make any changes to the last bullet. We're
right.
Not going to include
so
public.
This is under choice and engagement.
Ensures yep. First students have.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then their
high quality
to yeah. meet their.
That's fine.
You'd prefer their instead of his, her?
Yeah.
Okay.
Did I have a second?
I did have a second.
Board Member Goff.
I have no problem.
Okay.
Does anybody have a problem with this one, or should we just call the vote? Call the vote.
Board Member Durham.
Presuming we're voting on the first half of the severed motion, you have not drawn the second half, is that correct?
No, she has.
Oh, you
she
have.
Has.
Mm-hmm. Then I'm a yes. Thank
okay,
you.
Perfect. Board Member Flores.
Yes.
Board Member Goff.
Yes.
Board Member Masnak.
Yes.
Board Member McClellan.
Yes.
Board Member Rankin.
Yes.
And Board Member Schroeder.
Yes.
Great.
I'd like to just thank Board Member Goff for her work on this. I
Well, thanks to both of you.
Yeah, thanks to both of you. Did a great job.
Very high quality work.
Dr. Flores.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, for crying out loud. Go for it.
We're almost there.
Okay. So, and I believe Board Member Masnak had made the motion and Board Member Flores had seconded the original motion.
So now we're voting as amended.
As amended.
If you say so.
Board Member Durham.
Yes.
Board Member Flores.
Yes.
Board Member Goff.
Yes.
Board Member Masnak.
Yes.
Board Member McClellan.
Yes.
Board Member Rankin.
Yes.
And Board Member Schroeder.
Yes.
Perfect.
Good. Yippee.
Yay.
Item 21, State Board of Education Member Reports. Should we start with Board Member Durham and just go down the line?
Yes.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of things. One is I did ask the commissioner to do a little research into the assessments that are given in what I would characterize as some of the more elite private schools to see if any of them, and my purpose was to see if any of them offered or used Park or any derivative of Park, and it doesn't appear that any of them do. So they're at least as in high quality education. There is
they can't.
I don't know whether they can or not, but they've found other assessments that they find to be adequate. I thought that was an interesting piece of data. On the positive side, I had the opportunity a week ago Monday to visit with the superintendent, Mr. Pat Vershinsky of the Edison School District in El Paso County. And I would simply say, if any of you get depressed about the state of public education, I'll be happy to take you out to the Edison School District. It was a very positive experience. It's in El Paso County, and after living there 60 years, I have to admit I thought I'd been everywhere. But it's 49 miles from my home when I plugged it into the Garmin. And I didn't know you'd go 49 miles in El Paso County, but from my home, but you can. And the last couple of miles were on gravel roads that there was a little washboard effect on my car. Having said that, I'm going to build a board for the realignment, I think. But
good luck.
Lots of luck. But at any rate, it was the, as I recall, highest performing district in the state. They're operating out of a building that was built in 1922 and looks like it was built in 1822. That's the bad news. The good news is they have a $14 million BEST grant, and the construction was going on every place, and they're actually preserving. They're going to preserve the part of the 1922 building and have a essentially brand new facility for everything else. But it wasn't the facility that was impressive. It was really the commitment of the superintendent and the staff to the success of those students. And they have, I was about 30% free and reduced lunch population, a couple of extraordinarily creative programs accomplished on not all that much money, and a couple of personal notes that superintendent asked me not to mention, but so I won't, but things that were really very impressive that they're getting done. And to top it off, the free lunch that I got was delicious. And a school free lunch, that's, at least in my memory, remarkable. So they did a great job. They are going to have, I don't think it's scheduled yet, they'll have a ribbon cutting for the new construction when it's finished, probably in the fall, and I'm going to encourage as many board members as possible to attend.
Thank you. Board Member Flores.
Thank you. I have been attending the HOP meetings, and thank goodness, because I don't think I would make heads or tails of what we were talking about if I hadn't attended. Secondly, I went to the cop shop. I know this is, someone told me about it's an induction sort of year into looking into being a policeman. And these are high school students from Denver Public Schools who go and they attend and provide services and help for the Denver Police Department in school. They're like cadets. They're cadets their public school year, I guess their last year or possibly their 11th year in school. And I just thought these kids were great. I mean, their attitude, they were present at that cop shop and they're going to be there. They're going to give their time to be there and help the police department and also talk with kids in schools. And so I thought this was a great program. I like the kids. I'm going to look more into their cadet program, but I think when we're looking into professional development other than coursework, and this is one way that these kids can find out whether, you know, obviously if they go into it, they're thinking about being police people. So I liked it. Also, I won a $600, I don't know, the drawing, and I won the grill. I won a big prize. Secondly, speaking about private schools, I usually do this for the Arupe Jesuit Catholic School, and I help those kids every year for the Daniels Foundation. The Daniels Foundation gives scholarships. So I help interview those kids, not for the foundation, but to help them prepare for that interview that they're having with the Daniels Foundation. And I've enjoyed that very much. And so in a sense, you know, these are private, it's a private school, but this is an unusual private school in that they take from poor kids, especially immigrant kids who live in Denver. And they also have a very incredible work-study program that these kids work on Friday with usually the Department of Interior, U.S. Department of Interior, and it's the, it's a office under the Department of Interior, and they work in technology. So this is another area that I'm very interested, you know, in helping kids. I know it's a private school, but it's a good endeavor that they do with these kids. I wish we could look at their model too, or invite them sometime to come in and talk about their program.
Are you finished?
Yes.
Board Member Rankin?
I usually have more things to report during the month, but this month I just don't have that much. Scott Panko, the superintendent of Array, made an appointment a week ago to come over, and there was a snowstorm, and he couldn't get over the pass. And then the superintendents had a meeting this week in West Denver, and he was able to get there. And the second day he was there, he drove over, and we met with I met with him and the assistant principal, Kenneth Nelson. And they have a very unique situation, very small number of students in their school. It's one of those very small rural schools that use every community resource that they have. One of them is, one of the parents is a pilot and taught some of the high school kids how to fly, and even the superintendent said he went up in the plane, which is pretty interesting. One of the students made a 5-minute video, and I was going to bring it, but I did that the last time, so I thought I'd skip that. But it's very impressive about their band. They have a school band, and I think there were about 10 or 12 kids in it. So, I mean, it's not just two or three kids and everything. But they are doing quite well academically, and I think it has a lot to do with the involvement of the community, and I think Superintendent Panko's doing a great job out there. I wanted to share that with you. I also attended the lunch for BOCES, the Board of Cooperative Educational Services that was held over at the Capitol. I think it was the day before yesterday. So that's what I've done between the last meeting.
Board Member Trump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought about listing all of the staff members who have been kind enough to help answer all of my questions, but I think they're seeing me here just about maybe every other day, would you say, busy? Is that about right? sometimes for as many as three meetings in a day, and they've been really patient answering all of the questions that I have and giving me a really good feel for what they do in their departments. So I'm really grateful for that, and thank you very much. And we'll have more to come in the month of February. So if you see me down here and it's not a meeting day, that's probably why. I also had an opportunity to meet with community members in Northwest Aurora, and I'll be meeting with them again later this month. I've met with a number of local school board members within Congressional District 6, from Littleton Public Schools, Cherry Creek, and also from Adams 12 five-star schools. Later in this month, I'll have a meeting with Congressman Kaufman regarding an issue that a constituent has brought forward within the district that we share. I also had an opportunity recently to attend my first NASB conference out near DIA, and we focused on community engagement, and that was a really positive meeting.
I don't have much to report, but I would say that Dr. Flores' mention of Arupe Jesuit, two things. One is that the Independence Institute's Education Policy Center did a really great report and write-up on that school, along with several other private schools. Mm-hmm. And the second thing I would say is, to your point about it being a private school that we might want to look at, I think that's a really great, I would like to, I don't know when we're going to find the time given what we're looking at now, but I do think it would be instructional for us mm-hmm. to hear from some very successful private schools and for the public to hear what it is they do differently that public schools might want to try and emulate. So.
I don't have a lot of events to talk about, but I'll tell you what, if you really look at the hours on the clock that we all spend related to this in one way or another, I think it's astounding. I would like to add to the thanks and appreciation for the staff. I've also been able to benefit this past month from deepest conversations about the work. And every time I walk away, I've just been enriched. I've learned something new every single time, and a lot of admiration. I want to thank the commissioner for her spirit and how that works with everybody else here. It's great for us. We're very lucky. I also joined Rebecca and Val and Angelica at the NASB workshop. It was based, the whole point of the day was stakeholder engagement that continues after we send in this plan and after those days are over. So the point being that we want to really keep our communities all involved and feel like they have made a contribution and that their voice is important and valued and appreciated. And one of the things is, I think we'll have a chance to, when we can breathe a little bit about it, to sit down and think about what other kinds of folks or opportunities or learnings should we be adding into this and continue it on. And as always, I'm a big believer in Colorado's ability to carry out Colorado's plan. And we will get a good job of this done, and we'll keep at it. So thank you all.
Thank you. I'm not going to add much other than, as I have met either with any of my school districts and also had dinner with some of the superintendents at the CASE conference, I would say that the concerns around school finance are intense, the concerns are not only about what's not going to come from the legislature, but it's also about what are we going to do to them in terms of making decisions that are going to cost them more money. So we can talk about that some other time, but that was really most of the topic. The case presentation, the legislative presentation for on Friday morning, I thought was just excellent. It's probably one of the best ones I've ever been to. Had several different perspectives on school finance, national, local, district-wide. It was really very, very good. So I don't think we have any more public comment, or if we do, please step up. So I guess one other thing, now it's future business. I wanted to, again, point out the at-a-glance that was presented by staff to us. So for the next board meeting coming up, we sort of have some idea. We will be, do you want to state the districts that we know for sure that are coming?
The for March, we know for sure Cortez will be there.
Cortez, plus mm-hmm. the Westminster Appeal.
And the Westminster Appeal.
Okay, and we'll again be, of course, we'll have the draft of the ESSA plan
mm-hmm.
that we'll be talking about. I believe, well, we'll have some more rulemaking.
Yes, we have, I'm pulling it up right now.
Hearings, four of them coming up,
yes,
I believe.
We will have four rulemaking hearings that are staggered throughout the afternoon.
Right.
They won't take long, but.
Okay. So we're also going to have a legislative update meeting on March 31st. So I hope you'll be ready for that. We have in the past called in for those of us who were could not come be available. And then standards and review. So this helps us sort of get a sense for what's coming up next time.
You want to take go back one step to the end of February?
Oh, February. Sorry, I picked the wrong one. You're right. It's February 24th.
CASB Legislative Conference.
Mm-hmm.
The CASB Legislative Conference. I'm going to be out of town, so you have to help me what the dates are.
It's, I think, February 23rd.
23rd is our presentation mm-hmm. day.
And then
the main part for us, I think.
Yeah.
24th, I think I'm going to suggest that board members Rankin and Goff plan that out. Generally speaking, we've been given the impression that for the most part, districts want to be able to ask, board members want to be able to ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you probably want to lay some groundwork for
and
talk about it.
Discuss legislative priorities, perhaps.
Is this what, the 24th of
February?
23rd
and 24th.
23rd is the panel.
You're gone.
I will be
You're
out of
gone
town.
As well.
I will
yeah,
be out of town.
Right. Yeah, right. We're both gone. Snowbirds.
23rd and 24th?
Mm.
Uh-huh.
Yes. 24th.
And do we have a presentation?
Yes.
On the 23rd.
On the 23rd.
At 1 o'clock. Okay.
So and are you in charge? You're in charge. You and Ms. Goff can be in charge. To plan that out.
Do that.
You're supposed to be there to answer questions because primarily it's an opportunity for school board members to ask the board questions.
You could just have Jimmy answer for you.
It's kind of fun to spend the afternoon around.
Any other comments, concerns, new business, folks? All right, I think we are recessed until the 24th.
The legislative update meeting.
I don't know. I've seen
Oh my God.